There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week I talked to Anoush Shakalian, Stephen Bush about the aftermath of the Autumn Statement, and then Anoush joins us again with Barbara Speed to talk about the tampon tax. Plus, for perhaps one week only, Stephen's joke of the week. Then Jason Cowley talks to John Gray about our cover story on ISIS and the state. Well, we're joining you the day after the Autumn Statement, in which George Osborne made a series of announcements, pulled some rabbits out of a hat and various other political cliches. I'm joined by Stephen Bush, our Staggers editor, and Anoush Shakalian, our deputy web editor. So first, for anybody who's been under a rock, Stephen, what were the rabbits?
So the kind of big rabbits were the U-turn on tax credits. Well, it's a partial U-turn. In that he's basically said that there will be no cuts to tax credits, because it doesn't matter, because tax credits will vanish when universal credit is fully implemented.
It's quite a good illustration, that, isn't it, of the fact that a U-turn is less embarrassing than continuing to stick to something just blindly.
It is always the right course to U-turn. Andrew Adonis has a great phrase here: good governments U-turn and U-turn often. In this case, a bad government U-turns and U-turns very hard. If you take, say, the poll tax or the Iraq war, or anything where the government had a lot of opposition at the beginning, it got what at every point up until the point the policy was implemented, It would have been easier to U-turn, because once you've no one goes into the ballot box 5 years from now, 2 years from now, whenever the next election is in any of these circumstances, and goes, oh, the government would have done this awful thing. They go, oh, who cares? Yeah, people care about what governments actually.
What I really like is all the people who support Osborne now go very solemnly going, the best thing about Osborne, of course, is he's not ideological, which is a lie. He's incredibly ideological. He's a pragmatist. And this redefinition of the word pragmatist to mean has realised he has made a giant cock up, has rectified that rather than blindly clinging onto it, which is, which is the nicest possible gloss that you can put on that, right, Anoush?
Yeah, and weirdly, it's lucky for him that so many people opposed his policy to cut tax credits, because it means that Labour can't take full credit for his U-turn, because it was sort of roundly criticised. You had, everyone from Boris Johnson to The Sun saying that it was a bad idea. So weirdly, that worked in his favour. He seems to be riding on a wave of luck at the moment.
So also, apart from that, Stephen, we had the... I think Philip Collins in The Times was very interesting on the police number cut, saying that this is a classic budget Autumn Statement trick. You say that you're going to do something really, really bad, everybody piles into it and has a real go at it, and then you don't do it, and then the status quo by contrast then begins to look actually really appealing. And that was kind of what he did with police numbers, right?
Yeah, because we shouldn't forget that the police were effectively asking for more money at the start of the summer, and now they have the same effectively amount of money, and everyone is, well, not everyone, obviously some people, including many podcast listeners, are not relaxed about the police having as much money as they do at the moment. But the status quo endures, and that is seen as a big victory by lots of people. And it's kind of shot Andy Burnham's fox. He is having a terrible 2015.
I'm really enjoying... That's one of the really odd things about the budget, is it does bring out the kind of... There's a lot of foxes being shot, rabbits being pulled out of hats. I think maybe actually what we should try and do next year is try and introduce a few new animals into the budget and Autumn Statement vocabulary.
So, well, if someone messes up a policy, well, he's culled that badger.
Yeah, so if any of our listeners would like to write in with suggestions of other great animal metaphors we could try and get everyone to use, because clearly everyone's absolutely desperate to do it. Anoush, was there anything else that caught your eye?
Yeah, what was interesting was the, some of the things that George Osborne was saying about prisons, I thought. So they're closing Holloway Prison, which is a massive, famous, culturally interesting, historic prison in London. And it's part of what sort of Michael Gove's revolution, as he calls everything that he does, like he was in the Department for Education. Now he is in the Ministry of Justice, and he's using the same kind of language about transforming justice policy. And actually, it's very popular at the moment with the people in that sector.
I think it's very popular. There is a big problem with closing Holloway Prison, which is that it is, I mean, well, the reason it's being closed is the same reason that closing it is a problem. So it is in North London. It's between, you know, it's near Caledonian Road Tube Station, which is only one stop up for King's Cross. This is, you know, absolutely prime, you know, God knows how many like yuppie two-bedroom flats you can build on that land. So they are going to make an enormous amount of money by selling that off. The problem is that the Howard Eagar pointed out that the new prisons that they're going to build for women are going to be in Surrey. And this is a huge problem, particularly, you know, female prisoners, often most of them in prison for non-violent offences. You know, lots of them have children and families, and it's going to be really hard for them to get and see them. So one thing I think that everyone in the sector has been saying is it would be good if they were closing down Holloway Prison because they were considering more, you know, imprisoning fewer women, basically. But yeah, that's not necessarily where it looks like that policy is going.
No,
it is also a very atypical... So the announcement is we're closing down Victorian prisons, but it's actually an entirely renovated Victorian prison. It was rebuilt in its entirety in the 1980s, which is probably why it'll be so easy to turn into nice flats. Whereas your kind of, your genuine Victorian prisons, like, say, Strangeways in Manchester, is unlikely to be sold off, and remains these sort of huge, big universities of crime where people get shut off, lose skills. Yeah, but, you know, Michael Gove is actually saying lots of exciting things, so we hope that it will...
Well, I think he's in this, it's this kind of, you know, only Nixon can go to China thing, of the fact that nobody thinks that he's this kind of, you know, softly lefty, bleeding heart liberal. So he actually has kind of got the cover to do things that, you know, Ken Clark, with his much more soft, you know, softer reputation, found very difficult to kind of get past the Tory base, really.
Yeah, exactly. And when Ken Clark was trying to reduce numbers of prisoners, he was scuppered by the controversy that he sort of caused for himself by defining rape and that kind of thing. When you remember, he landed himself in a lot of hot water, and David Cameron in the end was just like, okay, no, just stop. Whereas Michael Gove has the respect from the right of the party that Ken Clark never did.
Well, the one thing I want to finish up by talking about, Stephen, is adult social care, which is not the sexiest of subject, but an incredibly important one. So care budgets mostly are paid by councils and have been incredibly cut back over the last 5 years. There's now a kind of little dodge scheme going on with councils being able to levy more council tax, right? Explain this to me in words of one or two syllables.
So basically, councils can now put 2% on council tax to meet their social care costs. Whereas before, Eric Pickles had introduced a thing where you couldn't increase council tax by that amount without having a referendum on it first. Obviously, having a referendum is A, expensive, but B, no one is ever going to win a referendum on can I put your taxes up, YN. It's good in a way. The problem arises, and if you have a large amount of social care costs, right, either if you have a lot of people who they've perhaps been moved out of, say, the centre of a city to a poorer suburb because they have long-term mental health issues, or they have learning disabilities, or they are incredibly old or suffering from dementia or any of those kind of reasons why you need social care, those are all groups of people who, for one reason or another, don't pay council tax. Pensioners don't pay council tax. People who have long-term mental illnesses tend not to pay council tax because they tend not to have jobs. So the concern is it creates a situation where...
So well-off councils with few people who need care will actually do quite well out of this, but or actually be fine to meet it, but people in other situations won't. I think that's right. And it's also ring-fenced entirely for adult social care, right, which means that child social care is not protected from the otherwise massive cuts that are happening to local government over the next 5 years.
Yeah, and it will basically mean what will happen with children's services is exactly what you're seeing with health. And basically, if you get sick and you go into a hospital or you go into a school, then you go like, oh, austerity doesn't seem to have happened all that much. But if you need an after-school club or you need to join a subsidised gym, for example, is a really important bit of health spending that most local authorities do. And some people who can only afford to join a subsidised gym, well, that saves money for the taxpayer long term because they're less likely to get heart disease, certain types of diabetes, etc., etc., etc. And all of that is going to continue to be cut. They have now handed councils the ability to keep the revenue from assets when they sell them off. Which is good in a way because it means some councils will be able to shield the rest of it. But of course, once you run out of assets, you can't sell them.
But that's like running through reserves,
yeah,
isn't it? I mean, so that's one, you know, when David Cameron wrote his famous letter to his council in Witney saying, have you thought about selling off expensive property? And they went, we've thought about that. And then we've done that, actually, is what we've done. There is a problem that's a stopgap solution. Well, we'll pick up another issue in a minute. But for now, it wouldn't be complete without discussing Labour's response, which I think it's fair to say the coverage has been entirely dominated by John McDonnell's decision to wave Mao's little red book at George Osborne, saying, you know, you're very close to China, maybe you'd like to read this, throwing it down on the dispatch box. Osborne, in rare comedy zinger moment, came back with, oh, is this your personal signed copy? And generally the reaction has been, if you're a chancellor or shadow chancellor who you know, the weaknesses that the Tories are trying to exploit is painting you as pretty close to a communist, you know, certainly, you know, stridently left-wing, is it really a good idea to have a photo of you brandishing Chairman Mao's little red book? Stephen, McDonnell has been on TV this morning saying that voters don't really care about this. They'll see past the media spin. Is that true?
No, of course it's not true. I mean, people in general, the media, everyone cares more about trivia than they do about the ins and outs of policies. And for any of our listeners getting irritated about that, I challenge you to tell me, without Googling, what was the name of the general who was on every front page other than the Mail's the day of Piggate, you don't remember. And that guy was the...
I didn't even remember there was a general on the front page.
This was the guy who said that there would have to be a mutiny if Corbyn won. Now, some would argue a mutiny is a bigger story than the Prime Minister potentially putting his penis in a pig. But...
not for the pig.
But yeah, well, not for the pig. But we all talked about it a lot more because people are more interested in gossip.
But also the fact that it plays into... things become emblematic, don't they? That's the problem. If he'd picked up any other book, if he'd picked up a Chinese poet, or if he'd picked up a kind of copy of Yung Cheng's Wild Swans, any of those things would have been fine. But the problem was that it punched a bruise. It was something it was a message that Tories are already trying to get on. You know, this guy is so left-wing, he's basically a communist. And then he gave them that thing that they needed. You know, if he'd held up... book by Oswald Mosley, it wouldn't have worked the same. That was the...
Yeah, and I think even if he had just quoted it, it wouldn't have been half as bad. But because there is now footage of him holding the book and waving it in Parliament, that can be used forevermore against him.
And also, just like... so obviously... well, okay, so I was going to say obviously. There is an open debate about whether or not it is good or bad for Britain to have the relationship with China than it does. Obviously, John Ross, who's one of... Corbyn's sort of strongest allies and a kind of closely within the orbit of the Corbyn circle, thinks that China is a very good thing. Others disagree. But it's not really electorally relevant. What he needed to do is stand up and go, ha, 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 you've done a U-turn, I win, and basically sit back down again.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I mean, the China discussion is really interesting, and we've covered it a lot. Again, I suspect when we covered that 2 weeks ago, or whenever it was, when the Chinese state visit was happening, that attracted rather less attention than people complaining that people are upset about the Little Red Book incident. Because it was just a fact. It wasn't a way to sort of signal your political allegiance about anything. But I think that Labour's response could have been a lot sharper. I saw Yvette Cooper and Chris Leslie kind of going through the figures, because that's one of the things that, you know, you absolutely have to do, and go and find... I mean, I remember the budget in the summer, you know, it was this idea that the tax credits versus the minimum wage, you know, Osborne was giving with one hand and taking away with the other. And it took quite a while for people to look and scrutinise the small print and the IFS to look at the figures and go, oh, actually, this does not in any way, one of these does not cancel the other out at all. And that's credit to John McDonnell. Until that point, he was doing quite well. And it is an about the most thankless task in politics.
Well, the thing he's done, this is incredibly insidery, but the thing he's done that I think is a mistake is he's abandoned the post-autumn statement kind of late afternoon briefing. And this is something that Ed Balls always used to do and Chris Leslie would do, because the shadow chancellor can only ever get done over in the set piece because they literally have to react live. Whereas if you do another briefing at 5 to all of the to the press, you can get your message out. It was that briefing under Chris Leslie was the first time that the Labour politician went, oh, those tax credit cuts, they're going to be a problem. Because people forget, although under Harriet Harman they said they weren't going to oppose the 3-child limit, they were opposed to the bulk of the tax credit cuts. And that's the kind of detail you can get out. I always really enjoyed Ed Balls' posting briefing because they were really interesting. Yeah, he had this huge brain. And it
was wonk heaven, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was wonk heaven.
But I think that that's something that people, if you're watching the speech on TV with the BBC kind of flashing the main points at the bottom, or if you're watching it live on Twitter, because, you know, if you follow the kind of a decent spread of political journalists, you can very quickly see what the big themes are. Sitting in the chamber, just listening to the words happen, and you don't get a chance to go, hang on a minute, what was that bit? Let's scroll back, what did he say just then? Mm. I just think people maybe don't kind of grasp how tough it is to pick out the needles in that haystack live in real time.
And I suspect the reason why he didn't do that briefing is he's never done it before. We forget that the reason why Ed Balls knows it's hard is he used to advise Gordon Brown. The reason why Chris Leslie knew it was hard is he used to advise Gordon Brown. The reason why Yvette, and this is kind of it's the first time in 20 years that a Brownite hasn't been in the Treasury team for the Labour Party. You know, more than that, because Gordon was chief sec before. A shadow chief set before, so they understand how difficult it is. Whereas I think John McDonnell sees it, goes, oh, you just stand up, you make a few jokes, and it's fine. But actually, you do need that bit afterwards when you can sit back to the fine print, call all the journalists back and go, actually, I know I stood up and said this was the important thing, but the really important thing is this. That is one of the things where I think everyone thinks they have to get a bit better at that, right?
Well, I do think that there are two lessons kind of from, particularly from that poll that you Gov poll that came out saying that 66% of Labour members think Corbyn's doing well, 86% of people who vote for him think he's doing well. I think there's a point now where if you're in the PLP and you're not, you know, on your kind of crazy kamikaze mission, you think, well, this is probably a very good, a period of silence is probably my best time now. But equally well, I think from the point of view of the leadership, the strategy of slagging off the media and saying no one listens to them has now been tested to destruction, and it is a very limited strategy. You know, you might hate the media, you might think they're all a bunch of bastards who misinterpret everything you say, but they exist, they are a fact, and I think they're complaining.
You can use them. He's been complaining about the press spinning the Mao stunt, but he could have spun the press. He could have done that briefly.
Well, that's the bit I don't have any sympathy for, because, you know, you're basically, people are writing up something that you did that you wanted them to write up.
Exactly.
It's just they're not writing the thing that you wanted. So, well, no one gets that apart from, you know, J.K. Rowling and her copy approval. Well, that's a weird note to end on. Anyway, thank you very much, Anoush and Stephen.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And we host the New Statesman's pop culture podcast, Seriously.
This week, we talked about horror parody show Scream Queens, the film of the Alan Bennett play Lady in the Van, and 90s children's dog-themed TV show Wishbone.
You can find us at newstatesman.com/SRSLY or on iTunes or on the podcatcher of your choice.
Hello, I'm Jason Cowley, editor of The New Statesman, and with me today is John Gray, political philosopher and writer, and one of our favourite writers on The New Statesman, John.
Thank you.
You've written this cover story, very provocative cover story, in which essentially, at the very beginning of the piece, you announce two things. One, that the state, as you see it in the aftermath of the Paris attacks, and more pressingly, the rise of Islamic State, you say the state is returning to its primary function, which is one of providing security.
That's right.
And you also say that the liberal order in Europe is not only crumbling, it's already history. So do you want to talk a little bit about that? And then I know you bring Hobbes into your argument. Mm. So tell us a little bit about what you're thinking.
I think the most fundamental lesson of the Paris attacks is that liberal societies underestimated their own fragility because they thought a certain narrative of freedom was spreading throughout the world. In other words, they thought of themselves as in the avant-garde of historical development. There might be problems, there might be difficulties, there might be periods of regression or even periods in which freedom wasn't spreading or was reversed in some countries, as some would say happened in post-communist Russia. But on the whole, freedom was spreading everywhere. So they allowed this their sense of the exceptional character of liberal societies, the fact that there have been very few in history and they've never extended very far, to be blurred by the sense that these liberal societies were actually a prototype for the whole world. And although there was perhaps nothing inevitable about it, it would take time, there'd be difficulties, there'd be setbacks, there was a kind of ongoing movement of liberalization afoot in the world. And that led them to forget a crucial fact, which I think has been almost put out of mind by contemporary liberal thinkers, which is that freedom itself is fragile because it depends on security. It depends. Freedom is not a kind of normal condition for humankind, which comes into being as soon as you get rid of tyranny. When you get rid of tyranny, what very commonly happens, and has happened in Iraq and Libya and to some extent in Syria, at least to the extent that the Assad regime has been weakened, you very often get a period of anarchy, which in its own way can be just as inimical to freedom. So what they forgot was that freedom, far from being a kind of a universally desired condition which is in some deep sense humanly normal, is an artifact. It's an artificial condition created by state power. It exists in the shadow or the shelter of the state. But when the state forgets its central functions of providing security, of providing safety from attack, of curbing violence, and then it becomes vulnerable. becomes vulnerable to attack. And I think this liberal dream of a form of political order which can be sustained only or principally by a commitment to freedom was embodied in the European Union.
Yeah, but John, the European Union hasn't collapsed. I mean, it's under great pressure, perhaps.
It hasn't collapsed. Liberal values won't disappear. But
yeah,
what
had the Eurozone crisis, and now clearly the refugee crisis is putting enormous pressure on Schengen, which seems to me unravelling.
Well, that I think is one of the key elements of the present situation, because I don't see how Schengen can survive the current terrorist crisis against the background of the migrant crisis. And I mean, the idea that the migrant crisis and the terrorist crisis can be linked is, of course, controversial and very offensive to some people, including Barack Obama, who's dismissed it as hysterical and who's said, you know, are we to be afraid of orphans and three-year-old orphans and their mothers and so on? But of course, it does seem to be, if you think from a Hobbesian point of view, you only need a very small number of ISIS supporters or jihadist militants to be among the million or more refugees, to be able to travel across Europe as, according to some reports, the ringleader of the recent attacks in Paris did, from Greece to France and commit the attacks. In other words, you have a situation in which, under Schengen, the borders of France are the perimeter of Greece. And this leads to a kind of rather interesting, if you like, theoretical result, which is that the European Union claims the prerogatives of statehood without being able to satisfy the primary function of the state, which is security, because it can't protect its perimeter border. That's not practical.
Doesn't have a common defence policy.
Doesn't have a defence policy.
Doesn't have an army.
Doesn't have an army. Can't do it. It doesn't have the capacity and won't be able to do it in the foreseeable future. So, but internally, it has a free zone, which means that anyone who passes through this very permeable border can go anywhere. And that means that the EU, far from being what many Eurosceptics think it is, which is a super state in the making, is a pseudo state from the standpoint, the Hobbesian standpoint of providing security. Can't do it. So that's why it's in a problem. So what's disappearing in Europe is not liberal values or even liberal societies. They'll survive. But the idea of an ideal transnational liberal order founded only on a common commitment to freedom is an illusion. And that's one of the illusions that I think Hobbes' thought is useful in puncturing.
You return in your essay to to Hobbes, who was born in 1588, the year of the Spanish Armada and the invasion. He lived for nearly, more than 90 years. He lived through a period of convulsion and war, the English Civil War, war in Europe. So he saw, in a sense, perpetual conflict. But John, how, when you talk about a sovereign political entity exists to secure the safety of its subjects, now what do you think the state needs to do or will do in the weeks, months, years ahead? Do you think we're going to see a fundamentally different state in a Western democracy such as Britain?
The first thing that will happen in Europe is the reinstitution, I think, on a pretty well permanent basis of border controls by nation states, because given that the transnational European institutions constitute not a state but a pseudo-state and can't perform this function, it devolves back to nation states. And so that's probably the first thing that will happen. There may be, no doubt, lots more cooperation in intelligence and other areas between these states than there's actually been up till now, because that's a clear failing that that's occurred. In Britain, I can see this crisis reinforcing the case that has been made for mass internet data collection. And liberals,
so more democratic acceptance of surveillance, greater surveillance, greater powers for the state.
I think it'll go through in Britain without much difficulty now. And one of the arguments for that, I think, is that if the state's primary function is to protect the safety of its citizens, then freedoms aren't a kind of a fixed set of harmonious liberties that join together and interlock and dovetail, which is how most contemporary liberals, who are very much influenced by rights theory and American theories of jurisprudence, they think about freedoms as a kind of dovetailing set. They're fixed, they all support each other. But in fact, in the real world, what actually happens outside the seminar room and the law court is that very often, if you're governing a country, you have to choose.
So you're talking about competing freedoms.
Competing freedoms. And there will be some loss of freedom. Privacy, which is already, I think, heavily challenged and may already be actually itself history as well. I mean, the privacy that existed prior to the internet will be further invaded under comprehensive or mass data surveillance. But I think there can be an argument for that. The argument for that is that although by itself it doesn't deal with many threats, threats continuously multiply, they proliferate, they mutate continuously. If it can prevent even some of these episodes, then surely there is at least something to be put in the balance there. And to reject this kind of action by states out of hand seems to me to be a kind of unreal perspective. It's again the idea that ultimately states exist to serve freedom, whereas to embody freedom or a complex body of freedoms, whereas the Hobbesian perspective would say what states exist primarily for is to secure the peace, and freedom is a byproduct of that.
It seems to me very easy to destroy a state, as we saw in Iraq, we've seen more recently in Libya, now in Syria.
Yes.
But extremely difficult to recreate a state.
Nobody
has to do it. Now, you've been very sceptical about so-called liberal intervention in Iraq, Libya and elsewhere. Yes. But, as I understand it from what you've written this week, you are open to some form of greater intervention against ISIS in Syria. And now David Cameron will once again return to the Commons to try and get authorization for British military strikes against ISIS in Syria, maybe as part of a larger multinational force, perhaps even including the Russians, working closer with France and the United States, as well as the United Kingdom. What is your sense that the British should do vis-a-vis ISIS in Syria?
Well, you're right, Jason, that I was more than a sceptic. I was adamantly opposed to the Iraq war, and I've never reluctant to... My first statement of opposition to the Iraq war was in the New Statesman in 2002, that's to say a year before the war was actually launched, and I was adamant. I thought it would be a catastrophe. I thought it would be ruinous. I thought it could lead to what I described in the New Statesman as Chechen-like anarchy. That has happened. So I don't reluct on any of that, but that's water under the bridge, even though in those interventions, which destroyed, weakened the state of Iraq, destroyed the state in Libya, and semi-destroyed the state in Syria, are among the conditions which have allowed ISIS to thrive and produce this terrible threat. Even though that is the case, we shouldn't argue that because these earlier interventions and earlier wars were misconceived, we can't do anything now. That's absurd. There's a genuine threat now.
You mean a genuine threat beyond the borders of the Middle East? It's
beyond the borders
of Europe and the West.
It's in Europe, and it's a threat.
And Assad is no threat to the West.
It's a threat to Europe, to Britain, to Pakistan, to Afghanistan, to Nigeria, to Kenya, to many, to Turkey, throughout the world. Whereas Assad is a threat to no one outside the immediate Middle East and to numbers of his own citizens. So I think we've got to take this very seriously now and be ready to respond in a coordinated international effort, but one that would go beyond, it would have to go beyond bombing. Bombing doesn't work in and of itself. It can weaken supply lines and destroy infrastructure.
So boots on the ground?
It has to be boots on the ground. And the real question is whether there's the will to do that. The Obama administration doesn't seem to have much stomach for the job. And also there's the question of, can it work without active collaboration with the Russians? And I don't think it can. And that has a further geopolitical consequence, which is, can Western intervention work while it is still the policy, in some sense or other, of the United States and Britain, to unseat Assad? Assad might ultimately be persuaded to go in some non-violent way.
As part of some longer negotiated settlement.
Which would have to include the Russians. Yeah. But the result of toppling Assad, if that won't probably happen now, toppling him violently, would probably be the disintegration of the Syrian army. And all of those supporters of Assad who fear for their lives.
You mean the minorities?
The minorities, the Alawites, the Druze, the Alawites in particular, who are under the protection of the Assad regime, despite its enormously violent and repressive character. They believe, I would accept their belief, that their lives would be worth nothing if the regime collapsed. They would flee to Europe. And what you would be left with then in Syria would be an anarchical jihadist killing field with no state at all. That would be catastrophic. So if there is to be military intervention, which I would support against ISIS, on a large scale, ready to put boots on the ground for a long time, and it's a question whether the will exists for that. If that's to happen, it has to be against a background of changed policies and with a degree of international cooperation that has never so far been achieved.
But should Britain act even without some kind of UN authorization? In alliance with the United States, France, potentially Russia too?
What I thought was wrong with the Iraq War wasn't the fact that it was illegal. It was the fact that it was a war that was not necessary and whose predictable consequences were disastrous. Mm. Similarly now, although it's much better to have UN support, and you might get it if there's, of course, there might not be a Russian veto if we're acting in concert with them. I don't think it's crucial.
And John, while you're here with us, it's worth segueing into the Labour Party, I think, because you wrote an essay in The Statesman in February, where you predicted that because of the failings of Ed Miliband's leadership, we were entering a new era of Conservative rule, and so it has turned out. Now, Labour is led by Jeremy Corbyn, who's an isolationist, a peacenik, possibly a pacifist. Mm. He always argues for negotiated settlements and is opposed to any form of military intervention. Where do you think the Labour Party is at present? It seems to me it's the weakest it's been for very many decades, even weaker than it was in the 1980s when it was weak then but still strong in Scotland. What do you think are the consequences for the Labour Party being led by Jeremy Corbyn?
I did write that in February of this year in the New Statesman, but I was also following on from, I'd learnt from some of the things you'd written about Ed Miliband that had confirmed my own intuitions, which is that the Miliband assumption or analysis, according to which what Britain was longing for was a move to the left, seemed to me to be incorrect. What I didn't anticipate, and perhaps no one did, was that by changing the rules of the Labour Party and of elections to the Labour Party leadership, the Labour Party membership and election to the leadership, what Miliband would do as an unintended consequence of that change was to trigger the Corbyn phenomenon. Mm. I don't think any of us anticipated the Corbyn phenomenon. And it's left Labour, not only weaker than it then was, Labour was already, after the last election, in my view, already weaker than it had been in the 80s, because it had irreparably lost Scotland.
Yes.
And the loss of Scotland is fundamental here, because Scotland can't be regained because it is now a separate political culture. There is no way that Labour can revive itself there. It's a separate political... And even though at some point, perhaps quite soon even, maybe the SNP will peak and reach some kind of start declining in popularity, unable to deliver or have other problems, what will then happen is it will either factionalise or new parties will be created on its left, which are Scottish parties, and not parties whose ultimate roots are in London. So Labour's lost that, even before Corbyn, in other words, Labour. But now it's incomparably weaker even than that, and certainly, as you say, much weaker than in the 1980s, because it's also got crumbling working-class support in some, yes, of its traditional bastions, where UKIP is strong, and where even maybe the Conservatives may make advances in some cases. And the new Labour leadership, not just Corbyn, but the people, most of the people he surrounded himself by, don't have the political experience that even the Michael Foote and others had in the 1980s.
Those who stayed in the party and didn't leave to join the SDP, like Healey, for example.
No.
Hattersley.
No, they carried on and they were there.
They were there later.
They're not going to repeat that mistake. Again, the trouble is that now Labour is, so to speak, alienated perhaps 80 or 90% of its parliamentary leadership of the MPs, alienated maybe 80% of the MPs. It's essentially an activist party that doesn't really fit very well into the British political tradition, because to be in opposition means you can form another government and you have to have a parliamentary representation and a shadow cabinet which voters would support. They don't have that. They're essentially much weaker, I share your intuition, than they've ever been in my lifetime. Mm. And I can't really see how this weakness can mean anything other than the loss of at least one, very likely two, and possibly more general elections. So we're not talking about 5 years, we're talking probably about 10 or 15 years. Of conservative rule,
as you predicted,
as I predicted,
even before the rise of Corbyn,
I did not anticipate the rise of Corbyn, but I thought the consequence, even of a narrow Miliband victory, which in February still seemed possible, would have been a short-lived Miliband government, which would have suffered so many buffetings. It had so little that was practical and feasible to offer on economic issues, that it would have probably succumbed in 6 or 12 or 18 months to... Yeah.
Particularly if it was part of a
coalition with the government. Would have succumbed.
Okay, John, that's terrific. So we've covered anarchy, security, terror, the state, yes, the Labour Party. Do read John Gray's essay in this week's New Statesman, and thanks very much for listening.
Thank you.
Well, there was plenty for women in the autumn statement. No, of course there wasn't. I'm lying. I'm joined by Anoush Kalian and Barbara Speed just to talk about a couple of announcements that came up. The first one, Anoush, is the tampon tax. Now, I'm going to give a rare small moment of praise for George Osborne for saying the word tampon in the House, which, as we know, Gordon Brown in his time refused to do. Mm. But would you like to perhaps give us some of your insight about what might have happened at the meeting where what he did about the tampon tax happened?
Yeah, well, this is how I imagine they came up with the policy.
Guys,
says a male special advisor in George Osborne's office as they work late into the night finishing off the spending review.
What about, like, women?
Nods another, finishing off his Byron burger disguised in a McDonald's bag.
You're right, we haven't put any women in it.
Maybe we should give some extra money to women's charities. I think there are some left. How about it, lads?
Moots somebody else, probably a man. Everyone stops what they're doing. Someone removes his tie and solemnly rolls his sleeves up.
Money? Where from?
Obviously not man money. We need that for proper things.
Laughs the kind heart who wishes to fund women's charities.
We'll get women to pay for it themselves.
How? They don't have any money to spend because our austerity programme hammering them disproportionately hard.
Chorus some treasury bods in the background.
Well, they pay for those luxurious little cotton thingies. They're always buying those. It's some kind of monthly tax, I think. We could spend that on them.
Brilliant!
Cries the Chancellor. And the most ridiculous announcement in this year's autumn statement is born.
I think that was moving, actually, is what that was. It was a profoundly moving experience. And just to give people the background to this, actually, it was, in fact, a male MP, the wonderfully named Will Quince, who came up with the idea. So George Osborne announced that there is a 5% VAT on tampons and other women's sanitary products. That can't be changed because of the...
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
EU, boo, hiss, and taken down to zero. So instead, he's going to earmark that money for women's health and domestic violence charities. Now, it's one of those things where I feel like the intention, I think, is really good. Do you not? I sort of think I can see how that came across as being a good thing. But in the end, Anoush, something about it's just a bit...
As soon as he announced it, I felt immediately uncomfortable about it. And I tried to think about why. And I think the reason is because it's sort of... I know they already give money to women's charities anyway, but it's almost saying only money raised from women's things can go to women's issues. It's kind of like, it's your problem, so you pay for it. Because only women,
Yes, I think that's the bit that got me, is the kind of bit about, you know, you have to pay for it. So you have to pay for this thing that only women have to pay for. And then it has to go to problems that women have. But in the case of, I mean, it wasn't just women's health charities, which I initially thought it was. It's actually domestic violence charities. Yeah. And that's what you kind of go like, well, that's not my problem, actually. That's men's problem. Like, maybe just if men would stop committing domestic violence, we wouldn't have to have those shelters. It's not women's problem to solve.
Exactly. Maybe the tax that they collect on men's things like razors or something, maybe they should use that to pay for domestic
violence. Exactly, those weird bulldog yeah. Like some grooming products that are designed to reassure men that moisturizing is okay.
Yeah.
Barbara, you know, there was a donut yesterday as well. How did you feel about the donut?
Well, it wasn't complete, right? It was like a three quarters donut, which I suppose is part of his whole thing, right? That like you can kind of do a bit for women. There's like a few women and there's one policy for them. Despite the fact that he's created a policy to plug a hole that he created by shutting...
Do you think there are people listening who don't know... I should say what a donut is for anyone who is not au fait with the delicious confectionery-based metaphors that politics uses. The idea that when you stand up to make a speech in the House, if you're a male politician, of which there are many, you get a ring of women around you. I think probably the real concern with this dates back to the time that once they end up at PMQs with an all-male Tory front bench, and Ed Miliband, quick as a flash with his comedy routine as ever... pointed it out. And ever since then, obviously, it's been some unfortunate in CCHQ's job to make sure that there is always a woman in shot every time that either David Cameron or Osborne speaks. Apart from that, though, how good was this? You know, what else was there for women in this?
Well, I suppose the supposed protection of social care budgets would be good for women because it hits women disproportionately hard that there's been so many... cuts and tightening of budgets around those kind of things because they're the ones who are the prime carers. But I don't really think there was anything in there that was particularly wonderful for women.
Yeah, and his continued cuts have been proven time and time again to hit women the hardest. And like this, I suppose what's particularly insulting about the tampon tax funds being moved across is that he gets to act like he's given women something, whereas in fact he's just taken huge amounts of money from them. And £15 million sounds like a lot, but it is not a lot.
I know,
at
I didn't
all.
Know how to explain that to someone yesterday, and they were like, £15 million is a lot of money. And I was like, well, if you gave it to me, it would be a lot of money. I would, you know, that would be a large person for an individual to have. But in terms of, you know, running a school or a hospital,
and
it's...
We covered a Department for Work and Pensions advertising scheme, which was basically like a horrible animated monster on television, which I don't believe anyone's actually seen. And they spent £8.5 million on that. And they were like, women, two of those. We'll give them two of those. And it's just so insulting, really.
Yeah,
it?
And someone was someone who took issue with the piece that I wrote about why the tampon tax announcement was so crass, was saying this is the reason why people are threatened by feminism, because you complain about money being given to women's refuges. And I just, you know, I don't think we should be grateful for £15 million a year or whatever it is, because the reason why domestic abuse shelters and rape shelters and things are under so much pressure is because of cuts from this chancellor.
Yeah, there were figures out from Women's Aid yesterday saying 43% of women's shelters don't have funding beyond May 2016. Yeah. And that's not purely as a result of the cuts, that's a result of lots of the general trend towards things like outsourcing. So councils will now run everything on, you know, quick turnovers. You're under a lot of pressure if you're a specialist provider to compete with big generic outsourcing firms that have got lower, you know, because they've got big central management warehouses, they've got lower overheads there. So yeah, there is, it's a really difficult climate. I think that is probably really actually that what I it felt like the consolation prize on top of a big cake made of poo.
And like they've shut about 30, haven't they, in the past 4 years, women's refuges, which is 15 million is not going to bring
it back. It is really tough. Okay, well, that's good. Well, we've, yeah.
We're all screwed.
On that dispiriting note, thank you, Barbara and Anoush. And now we're bringing back, especially by great listener demand, a segment we like to call Stephen's Joke of the Week.
So there are a lot of different views about the tampon tax. I actually quite like that section because it's actually given us a whole new sheath, as it were. Sheath is not the right word. The joke of the week is going badly already. A whole new range of euphemisms for that time of the month, because George Osborne, in a moment which I'm sure made sense in the office, compared people's periods to the LIBOR rate rigging scandal, which is when bankers effectively just lied about the seaworthiness of their banks, which is brilliant because it now means that instead of just...
I thought you said seaworthiness then. It's like you're really working this in.
Instead of saying, oh, is the Red Knight seeking lodgings, you can now have, oh, are the bankers lying about their MiFID II requirements? Oh, is the AAA rating at threat? You're like... Oh, are you separating retail from investment sectors? It's a whole new world of innuendo. So I say, thank you, George Osborne.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, and produced by Anna Leskovitz. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.